Radio City, once again, John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you, and we have finally managed after 4 or 5 days to digest everything we ate on Thanksgiving Thursday. And Rob Ross, how's everything going in New York?
It's going great. I know you weren't feeling well, and I hope you're doing much better now.
Thanks.
On this end, what can I say? Thanksgiving was absolutely perfect on all levels. Everything went like clockwork. The meal was exquisite. We had a great time. It was just a very warm, relaxing, and joy-filled afternoon. So I am a very happy man.
Good for you. Good for you. And I found out that I don't like smoked turkey as much as I thought I might. So,
well, you know, it's like there are acquired tastes out there, and every now and then you go with a bit of a different program on the Thanksgiving menu.
Right.
For years, we didn't want to cook because, you know, you work right up until Thanksgiving Eve, and to have to rush and go crazy and prepare and all of that for people to come over on Thanksgiving. For several years, we opted out to just go early in the morning to Boston Market and get the ready-prepared meal. The problem with that is no matter how you look at it, something in there is just always way too salty for its own good. And it also just gets tedious. So, you know, again, the acquired taste factor, there's nothing like a Thanksgiving dinner that's actually cooked at home in the proper and traditional sense.
No doubt, no doubt. And the thing of it, I don't really probably dislike smoked turkey. It's just that I like roasted turkey so much that not having that on Thanksgiving was, I thought it'd be, this will be fine. It'll be a nice change. And I think next year we're going to go back to just roasting the bird.
You know, the beauty of it is making sure that as long as it's juicy.
Yes.
That's always the key. And everybody always has their argument. Bag, foil, you know. We use this really nice, large, deep pot that you can, a roasting pot that fits in the oven perfectly for turkey. And every year it's the same thing. Juicy, tender. By the time we were done, once I put the serving fork into it, it was literally falling off the bone, but it was nice and moist. So.
That is the way it should be. Good man. Well, we've got a lot to talk over, and we have once again for this episode of the show, as we're going to do about once a month, thrown out the script, and we're just going to kind of have at it. So where's your brain taking you first?
Well, let's take it to Saturday night, this past weekend, since it was a nice, long, and relaxing weekend. I was able to score tickets to the theater that is literally about 35 steps from my apartment, the St. George Theater, which is this beautiful, and I mean just exquisite, it was a movie theater also for, you know, performances and so on, renovated, and it's a fantastic concert hall. I mean, I've seen Cheap Trick there. Back in the 80s, I saw Translator and the Red Rockers there.
Nice.
Saturday night, I was able to get two orchestra seats for Todd Rundgren, who I, of course, absolutely love and have loved since I first heard Hello, It's Me when I was 8 years old.
Sure.
And, you know, throughout most of this year, unfortunately, I had tickets for Todd when he played at City Winery, and a friend of mine went, Nick Celeste, the wonderful musician, and said it was a fantastic show. It was Todd basically out on this greatest hits, what do you want me to play kind of tour.
Right.
You know, and he said it was it was a dream show, you know, and that's the kind of reports I was getting as far as Todd's live performances. So we went to this show with all hopes and our appetites whetted for something like that. And I have to tell you, that is possibly in my top three of worst shows I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, no.
I was not only disappointed, I was genuinely angry. He came out and did this new album of his. I think it's called White Knight. It's a political album.
Uh-huh. This is,
that has that controversial track about the man in the tinfoil hat that he co-wrote with Donald Fagen. And it was too much shtick. And it was also based around dance music and rap. And I don't think it serves him well, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's 68 years old. That's a young man's game. You know, he had such a great band with him. I found that even more egregious because, you know, in his group is Prairie Prince from the Tubes on drums.
Wow.
His ever-loving stalwart, Kazim Sultan from Utopia on bass. Greg Hawks from the Cars on keyboard. The music was terrible because it's all this dance stuff. There were these interludes where he would have a track played from the album, and everyone would go off stage with this video stuff in the background so they could change outfits. And I was thinking, you've got to be kidding me. There's a bone in here somewhere. But that wasn't the case at all. It was almost as if he was trying to antagonize the audience. I don't know. I don't know where he was at, but it was so disconnected. And the audience is in my age range, or at least a little bit older. And these are very nice, polite people who paid a lot of money and took the time during their holiday weekend to come down to the show to see him, you know? And a lot of people paid money to park and so on and so forth, you know? And they all, you know, they were all very polite and clapped after every song, but as the show progressed and this just didn't seem to end, and it didn't seem like he was going to give us anything we wanted to hear.
Yeah.
The applause seemed to diminish more and more and more. And there were some people that walked out. And I admit, I stayed for the whole thing thinking, okay, maybe he'll give us something in the encore. By the time the main show was over, in which, by the way, the only older song that was included was this obscure Utopia track that I guess fit the timbre of the whole show, uh-huh. Some called Society. They went off for an encore. They came back, they did a Utopia song called One World, which I vaguely remember. It was towards the tail end of the Utopia era. An almost sarcastic spoof lounge slash CD 101.9 smooth jazz, easy listening jazz, whatever you want to call it, rendition of Hello, It's Me, which just was awful.
Why would you give the middle finger to your audience like that?
I don't know. Now, I know this much. There was a lot of negative reactions, and of course, you take Facebook for what it's worth, but there were a lot of negative reactions. You know, the St. George Theater posting Todd Rundgren at the theater. Of course, Staten Island is a Donald Trump stronghold.
Yeah.
And, you know, his attitude is, if you voted for Trump, don't come to my shows. And a lot of people were saying, well, Todd, guess what? I've been a fan for many years, but I voted for Trump, so I guess I'm not coming to your show if I'm not good enough. You know, that kind of – to me, it's a case of, if you're trying to give the finger to the audience on Staten Island, these are the people that didn't vote for Trump and are, or maybe voted for Trump but still see you as a great performer. And what was done was just so tasteless, and just – and the music was just completely unappealing to boot. I'm very disappointed. I'm equally disgusted. And, you know, I'll listen to the records and I'll always love the records, but there's nothing that will ever get me to spend my time going, even if I knew in advance that, yeah, he's going to do everything. Because I've seen clips from that last tour and he was bringing out Open My Eyes.
Yeah, you know? Right.
That's where he was delving into the catalog. You know, if you're not going to give us A Dream Goes On Forever or Can't We Still Be Friends or, you know, Couldn't I Just Tell You, or a proper version of Hello, It's Me? Well, forget it, you know, just forget it. So that was my first grievance. But more importantly than that, on Thanksgiving night, as wonderful as the day was, we got the very, very shocking and sad news that Tommy Keen passed away unexpectedly in his sleep on Wednesday night. And if you don't know Tommy Keen, you probably have heard the song Places That Are Gone, but he was a wonderful singer-songwriter, amazing guitarist, friend to everyone, just a good man, a good soul, a very kind person, an incredible fan of music, just one of those people that the moment you meet him, you know you've made a friend for life.
Yeah. Well, and that's – it is sad. And he was a young guy, too. Was he 56? 59.
You know, heart attack in his sleep.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to go, you know, you hate to say it, but still, not a bad way to do it. Whenever something like that happens and it's somebody that, you know, you go through all the cliches about, it's always the good ones, you know, but 59 years old, nowhere near enough time. And like you said, a talented guy, but on top of it, and much more importantly than that, a good soul. And there's not enough of those in this world.
It really pains me to see that, you know, he and I had a lot of mutual friends, and some of them were just going through hell right now in agony. And I feel it acutely with them. And, you know, of course, for me, there's a kind of double-edged sword of pain about this, because I was first turned on to his music by my ex-girlfriend, who is no longer here either. So I highly doubt that I'll be able to listen to, and it's on my iPod, and I've listened to it so many times, certainly the album Songs from the Film, which is his most well-known album. But, you know, I saw him just 2 years ago when he was on tour with Matthew Sweet, which he'd been earlier this year as well. And the one thing I took away from that concert, and we had a conversation about it, he and I, afterwards, you know, it was mostly acoustic, and he was playing a 12-string Taylor, which I have. And he just sounded remarkable. And in that performance, he did Nighttime from Big Star's Third. And, you know, when you listen to the song on its own, it's a very sad, kind of lonely and empty. It's an empty feeling that you get when you hear Alex Chilton. And yet, when you heard Tommy Keen perform it, especially live, there's a spark of hope in there.
And when I set my eyes on you, you looked like a kitty. And when you're in the moon, oh, you look so pretty. I caught a glance in your eyes and fell through the sky. Glance in your eyes and fell through the sky.
He turned it on its head, and, you know, anybody who was with us can tell you, I was sitting there and I was watching, and tears were just going down my face because it was just so beautiful and just so simple yet majestic the way he did it. You could have heard a pin drop. That's how attuned the audience were to listening to that moment. So, you know, it was just a really painful capper on an otherwise perfect day.
Yeah.
And, of course, earlier in the week, as a matter of fact, as you and I literally said goodbye to each other when we were recording show number 40, that's when the news broke that David Cassidy had, in fact, passed away.
Right, and that was not unexpected because, as we had said during episode 40, and I think during 39 as well, there were already people who had mistakenly said that he had died, of course, because everybody feels the need to jump the gun on these things. But he was in failing health for a fairly long time. But it doesn't take the sting out of it when the word finally comes down. And with the David Cassidy thing, my sister was the one, because she's 5 years older than me, who was obviously had the huge, you know, massive crush on him and the whole nine yards. But because of her, and because she controlled the TV remote at that point, I ended up watching a lot of those Partridge Family episodes, and it was almost like David Cassidy was a member of the family. I mean, there were the posters in my sister's room and all the Tiger Beat magazines and all of that stuff. And, you know, it was a career that, you know, he had a lot of singing credits later on, and I know he did the sort of Vegas residency, I think, for a while, and was always a performer. But those years, I mean, if you didn't live through them, it's hard to accurately describe exactly how much pull that guy had in pop culture.
Well, I very clearly, oddly enough, I mean, I was five when the Partridge Family came on. I was in kindergarten. And I remember, by the way, this is a sidebar. Remember when you and I talked about the first time we ever performed in front of an audience?
Yeah.
And what it's like? You know, there's actually an asterisk to that, because the first time I ever got up and sang a song was like me and some of my classmates pretending we were the Partridge Family, and we did I Think I Love You.
Nice.
So we were all 5 years old in kindergarten. And of course I was Keith because I wanted to be a guitar player. And I was singing. So, you know, those were great songs. That first album was terrific.
Yeah, and he actually fought for the use of his vocals. He and Shirley Jones were the only two from that show whose vocals were used on any of the music. And initially they wanted to use somebody else, and David said, no, I want my voice on this stuff or I'm not doing it.
Right, because they were in the first episode, and they used it sometimes as the closing theme in that first season. They're doing the song, Getting It Together, Moving Along, and it's not his vocal.
Right.
I also always had a problem with the fact that everybody sings that Come On, Get Happy. No, the original song is When We're Singing. You know, that was remember, it was a lot more boisterous, the opening theme song. Now, they also changed the lyrics. It was originally, because I always remembered this, and this always bugged me. Five of us and Mom working all day, we knew we could make it if our music would pay. Danny got Ruben to sell our song, and it really came together when Mom sang along.
Yes.
That's how it goes. Not that other, you know, come on, get happy. That was kind of fruity and faggy with the stupid harpsichord in it. You know?
That's right.
But anyway, you know, the thing is, he fought to get his vocals on. Then he fought just to get a little bit of money since it was his image everywhere, and he was making nothing. And I mean nothing. You know, he was treated literally like a piece of meat. He was just a commodity. Then, you know, he would go out and he would, it was almost a repeat of the Monkees, except it was only one person.
Right.
Having to go through all this, shoot the series during the week. Then on the weekends, every free moment was spent on the road, touring and performing. And the thing is, he was also incredibly good and generous with his time for the audience. That he always made that his priority.
Yeah.
You know?
And there was another thing that he was, it must have been contractual obligation stuff because there was so much of that. But we forget now that they used to bring in celebrities for openings of supermarkets and shit like that. And he did a ton of that stuff back in 1971, 72, 73. You know, he was everywhere. And it wasn't always performing. Sometimes it was just, you know, standing there and having girls come up and scream at him and sign autographs. But I remember him being in Buffalo and my sister being very sad that she couldn't go to whatever supermarket was opening that week.
You know, I also remember that he did an episode of Police Story.
Yes.
77, early 78. And he was good. You know, he was convincing.
Right.
You're able at that point, certainly, you know, what was it, 4 years after the show was done and, you know, I'm already a teenager at this point. You forget, you know, it's like, okay, granted, he was Keith Partridge, but okay, he's an actor, you know, that
right.
He's doing his job. And that in turn parlayed a briefly ran series called David Cassidy, Man Undercover.
You know? That one I missed.
That was on NBC at the same time that Eyeshide was on.
Okay, yeah. But, you know, again,
that's a one-two punch for you, David Cassidy and Joe Don Baker.
Oh, man, you got to love Mitchell. But the thing is, you know, I was thinking about this because with Shirley Jones still being not only alive but aware, I mean, you know, she's very much with it at this moment. And to see her stepson go through everything that he did, you know, go through that kind of dark side of stardom, go through the drug abuse and the alcohol and the girls and everything else, and then finally kind of get it together and then have his health fail on him like that. And his stepmom is watching all of this. The two of them meant so much to each other. And I notice I haven't heard any public statement at all. There may have been one that I missed, but I don't remember hearing Shirley Jones say much.
I think she's absolutely devastated by it.
How could she not be?
She just doesn't want to talk about it. It's not something to share publicly.
Right.
And I completely understand it. However, I did see, of all things, on Sean Cassidy's Facebook page, there was a billboard. I don't know if it was somebody had, you know, photoshopped it or whatever, but it was one of the Partridges from the opening credits, you know, the animated Partridge.
Yes.
That they had in the opening with a tear going down its cheek.
Aww.
And just dates. I mean, that was really sad and touching, but, you know, Sean Cassidy also went through the adulation of stardom and teen idoldom and the singing thing, which was very brief. And, you know, he worshiped his older brother.
Yeah.
You know, he loved him and he's absolutely heartbroken about it. But, you know, he's someone who, I think, who took the cue from his brother and said, I'm not going to make necessarily those mistakes.
Yep.
Because he hasn't, you know, he's had a very nice career as a director and writer, screenwriter. So, you know, good for him. But, you know, it's just, you said something that was very poignant earlier that, you know, he was basically a part of the family at that point, you know, because he was on TV so often. No different a feeling than when we got the shocking news that Davy Jones had died.
Right.
You know, it set me reeling for days. And I made the mistake the morning after the news in putting on I think it was Daydream Believer. And that was a huge mistake because I was sitting on the ferry crying.
Yeah. Well, when they did that song at the Monkees concert a couple of weeks later. Yeah.
Forget they'd forget it. I mean, you want to talk about one of the most touching moments ever. And I can, the one thing, you saw it and I saw it, and Mickey's words will resonate forever when, you know, he said, the song we're about to do, we talked about it a lot because Davey sang it. And we already knew that this was coming the minute he said yep. that. And he said, but we discussed who could sing it. And Peter said, I don't want to sing it. And Mike said, I don't want to sing it. And I don't want to sing it. And then we realized there's only one person who can do it, and that's you, because it belongs to all of you
right.
now.
Right.
And damn it, I'm getting choked up.
Well, that's, yeah.
So clearly, and not a dry eye in the house.
No.
I don't think even Mickey could get to, like, none of them could really get through it without having to pull the mic away. And the fact that they brought this woman up from the audience, just to, I mean, it was just such a powerful thing. But that's when someone has touched you in such a manner and they're suddenly gone, especially someone who was so beloved, who gave himself to his audience, it says a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it leaves a lasting, and I want to go out on a limb and say, hopefully positive legacy. And I hope there will not be any kind of obnoxious and hateful backlash or snarky commentaries the pundits are always want to do in the case of David Cassidy. He was a good guy. Like everybody else, he was human. He made mistakes, but he gave the audience everything.
Right, right. And
that's the bottom line.
And there's no fault there. So, yeah, sad goodbye for him as well. Now, I have to go back to Thanksgiving weekend because we did, when I was finally getting my head above water again and felt safe to go outside, we got invited to something. And I don't know, I mean, this is such a Midwestern thing. I don't know if this has even done its thing in New York, but is late night catechism a thing that you're familiar with?
Isn't that a Catholic thing?
Kind of, but it's not what it seems.
We're like midnight masses.
Yeah, but this is a stage show. This is different from that. So the idea is you have a woman playing a nun, and she basically does crowd work for an hour, but it's all based in all of the shit that we remember from Catholic school when we were little kids. And it's funny. So Late Night Catechism did its run. Now there's the Christmas version of it that's out. And we went to the Playhouse at Westport, which is, I think at max, it's a couple of hundred seats. And there were maybe 50 of us there on Saturday night. And it was, you know, again, so completely Midwestern. It's not, you know, it doesn't want to be edgy in any way, but it's fucking hilarious. I mean, it was just really good. We had such a good time. And the reason I bring this up is not to talk about, you know, the Christmas catechism thing so much as to note that I got, and this is a little behind the scenes, a note from the promoter of the show who had invited us to come on Saturday night. And she said, I'm really sorry, but the woman who plays Sister in the show, she said that the show you guys got to see was the worst one by far. And, you know, the audience was small and she said the other shows were packed and everybody was into it and laughing. And it just goes to show you how we are all, anybody who's in any kind of performance art, we are our own worst critics. And we will find a reason to pick something apart because Jen and I had nothing but a blast at that show. We thought it was hilarious. We thought she was great. The audience had fun. But when you're performing it and you have 12 other shows to compare it to, you forget sometimes that audience that you're in front of doesn't know that there was something else. You know what I mean? So yeah. Sometimes we get done with a show, and I've had this happen where I'll get done with a show on the radio, and I'll think, God, that was shit. I was off today. I couldn't get anything going. I couldn't get it together. It didn't felt disjointed the whole way. And I'll get an email from somebody in the audience who says, hey, that thing you said, I was dying laughing, man. That was great. And it's like, were you listening to the same show I just did?
I mean, God, you want to talk about being your own worst critic. When I went back and listened to 38 version number 2, you know, because I couldn't remember anything in version 1.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, it was, a free-form show. I was thinking, oh, Jesus, you know, could I have fucked that up any worse? And in listening to it, I thought that was one of the best things we've ever done in this permutation or even during the Overnight America era. So, you know, who are we to say? You know, who are we to judge?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Listen, I've only ever once been to one of those, I don't know what you want to call them, celebratory mass performance thingies.
Yeah.
But I did a pretentious thing because I was going out with a very pretentious woman at the time. And we wound up going to, I don't even remember the name of the church, but it was in the, I believe it was in the Village. And it was a performance of, of course, Handel's Messiah.
Yeah.
Wow. You want to talk about torturous. Now, on the flip side of that, around, not even around, a couple of years later, unbeknownst to me, because I was so out of it at the time and not really paying attention, our dear friend Mr. Barone actually oversaw the performance of the Downtown Messiah. And those shows have become fucking legend, and I missed them.
Oh.
We're talking about, you know who was in this? David Johansen is one of them. I mean,
from the Dolls.
I've got Buster Poindexter.
Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you something. How was your Shabbos? That's okay, fine.
Yeah. That's great.
I could have seen that. I could have seen Barone doing this thing, you know? I mean, it was fucking magnificent. And I got stuck watching some little chorale of young boys, and I don't even want to go near that topic of what that really meant.
Yeah.
Sing something. I could swear it said in the program, I'm not joking, something about the Pickled Boys. That's how they were referred. And it was like this over and over again refrain, like they would sing this whole thing, and then this one little kid would keep going, God be praised. And fuck, I am so glad I'm not a Catholic. I convert so fucking fast, your goddamn head would spin.
I think, you know, if you would ask somebody who pickled them, you would have been thrown out on your ass. So
I'm not, like I said, I don't want to even remotely go, yeah, I don't even want to use the word touch.
There you go. Oh, man. But yeah, all in all, it wasn't a bad weekend. And you know, one of these days I'll be healthy for a holiday, and then we'll know that the world is in fact coming to an end, which it may very well be, because not 3 hours ago there was another missile launch out of North Korea. Like, we needed this shit.
Did it work?
Well, it got out of the atmosphere. They still don't know whether it broke apart when it came back in or not. So.
Ooh. Fucking idiots.
Yeah.
I bet you he put in a call and told them to fire it so that way he can obfuscate everything that's going on.
Right. Yeah, like the Pocahontas crack.
I don't even know if we want to go into it because it's only going to set us both off.
Well, the thing is, I'm so sick of this treadmill, of the roller coaster, of all of this, because we know what it's about. I mean, the thing where he floated a day or two ago, oh, maybe the Access Hollywood tape was fake. I mean, come on, you already admitted it. But he's doing it, as you said, it's absolutely an obfuscation. Here's the problem, because there comes a point of critical mass where all he's doing is the next craziest thing. Because as long as he does the next craziest thing, he knows people will go, ooh, look at that crazy thing he just did. And they won't look at the fact that he's being investigated and the fact that he's a failure as a president and all of the other shit. So there comes a point, though, where the crazy thing that you have to do next is so insane that even the drooling mouth breathers who have been watching this circus act for the entire time are going to look at it and go, no. And they're just going to go home.
I got to cut you off there because I think you're giving a lot more credit than it's due them. Because, look, these are the same drooling mouth breathers that are still riding the train with Roy Moore.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, come on. I hate to paint it in such a violent way, but it's as if you had a guy stand there, shoot someone at point blank range in front of a crowd of 100 people. And he says, but I love Jesus.
Yeah, right.
And trannies can't use the men's room and can't use the ladies' room. You know, that's all they need.
Right. And as if it wasn't bad enough, as if it wasn't, you know, insane enough to have the one lawmaker in Alabama who said initially after the first day or two of the Roy Moore scandal, who said, well, you know, Mary was only a teenager and Joseph was an old man, as if that wasn't bad enough. Now, yesterday, there was another one of these Republican schmucks in Congress who said, well, you know, Ringo Starr sang You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine. So now it's Ringo's fault.
No, it's not Ringo singing it. Ringo is singing a Johnny Burnett song.
Right.
You fucking idiot. All you have to do is look at the writing credits, you fucking retards. And, you know, this is – I'm not even a Christian, but that pisses me off. That's about as blasphemous as you can get.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Blame it. Yeah, that's all Roy Moore was doing. He was trying to make a Jesus.
Maybe it's just me, but if JC ever came back, I think he'd probably be taking out a couple of these people. Don't put any money on him to be, you know, all Mr., you know – you know, turn the other cheek, you know. No, you people, if I can almost hear him say it now, you know what, I'm back and you've underestimated
me. That's right. Well, he flipped
me off. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to lay waste to you for all blaspheming.
That's right. Know? Well, yeah, he flipped over the temple and called all the money changers assholes, so he's got that. It's only one step farther, you know.
Just wipe them all out, and that would be a really great thing. That would make me believe. I mean, I'd still be a Jew. I wouldn't be a Jew for Jesus because they're just fucking nuts. But
I have to give credit. I have to give credit elsewhere on the website, elsewhere on popdose.com, because once again, our buddy D.W. Dunphy has done it. And you mentioned a column to me, and I don't know if this is the same one you're talking about, but in all of our lament about how nobody, and as a matter of fact, I even had this conversation with Barry Manilow about 6 months ago, about where the hell are the melodies? Where is a decent melody writer? Where is a McCartney? Where is somebody that can write something that is bouncy and hooky and catchy and just makes sense? And D.W. Dunphy actually found one and introduced me. I know he's written columns about them before, but he's got one from just a few days ago about Pugwash. Yeah.
Running down to greet the morning cover.
People have chatted to me for the longest time. I think they're from Ireland.
Okay.
Would that be right? I know they're big on the Omnivore circuit.
Okay, yeah.
Love them. I think they may even be on Omnivore. I'm not. Don't quote me on that.
But, it's fun stuff.
I've yet to check them out, but the thing is, you know what? I am so mired in an endless physical sea of CDs and some vinyl that are submitted for reviews.
Right.
DVDs submitted for reviews. And I can't even count the emails that come in on an hourly basis.
Right.
So I haven't even had the chance to sit down and enjoy something that people have mentioned to me on a personal level time and time and time again. But, you know, on the flip side of that, to answer the question, you know, where are the writers? There are writers out there. There are you know, writers, there are performers, there are musicians. And unfortunately, the only way they get exposure is if they submit to people like us who are willing to take the time and sit down and give it an assessment and say, hey, you know what, this is good. Listen, I had such enormous, and I do mean enormous hopes. I'm still lamenting this, what, 2 years later, that wonderful band from Arkansas, Little Chief.
Yeah.
I thought it's one of the best albums I'd ever heard, period. And within the span of the year of them releasing the album, they were gone. They decided to call it a day. Now, you know what? They put that one album out into the universe, and it's there for all time, at least.
Yeah.
That's what matters, you know? Listen, I can tell you about this most magnificent of songwriters. He's a fucking genius, a visionary, a hell of a nice guy, great singer, you know, can do all this stuff in his head, kind of like Brian Wilson without the hallucinations, you know. He's able to sing 8-part harmonies on his own in the studio, can play all the instruments. He put out a not bad album with his old band, but he hasn't put out anything, you know, solo. Why? Because he's the laziest bastard on the planet. I love the guy to death, and I, you know, I kill for him because, you know, he's just the greatest thing since sliced bread. But at the same time, do I hold my breath thinking that I'm going to finally, like, you know, my ex-bandmates in the punchline thinking, we were going to take our place on the mantle. No, I'm not delusional.
Right.
No, I'm not insane. I'm just magnificent. There's the difference, you know. But you're talking to one right now, a god of a songwriter. But the problem is, who gives the people what they want?
Yeah, radio. Radio has lost interest.
You know, you have to go back to that period. I always seem to hone in on this. It was especially towards the time when I was at Atlantic Records. That was when the whole Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys and the mass manufacturing of the new teen idol started to rise to the fore. And I felt it was all becoming – music was now secondary, if not way down on the pecking order. First of all, A&R men started disappearing.
Yeah.
That was the first warning shot that nobody really paid attention to, and that was a frightening thing. But the A&R departments started to evaporate. Blink, and they were suddenly gone. Now, all of a sudden, you know, materials were solicited by lawyers and accountants. Now, how that plays into it, I don't know for sure. But then, you know, of course, you had everything as a merchandising tie-in, you know, a jeans line and a perfume line and a lipstick line. And by the way, here's my new CD.
Right.
So it's all an afterthought. And then you have the criminals who brought us American Idol. And I think that just tore the whole thing apart.
Yeah.
You know, there were moments and flashes where you thought, okay, maybe things are turning around. Now, I didn't really care for any of these bands. Like, remember when the Strokes were going to be the biggest thing in the
sure,
world?
Right.
They sucked logs, and that's never going to change my opinion. But, you know, they were supposed to be spearheading this whole movement of guitar bands, especially from New York. There was the Strokes. There was the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs. There was a band called Ours, O-U-R-S. Interpol, who were out of all of those, they were probably the best, but they were just so Joy Division wire-y that I thought, yeah, I've seen this before.
Yeah.
I'll give you your credit where it's due, but I've seen it before, done better the first time by the originators.
Always is.
Yeah, I mean, and that's natural bias for me because I love Wire. Actually, out of all of those, that crop of bands and that whole wave of guitar groups that were borderline new wave-ish or punky-ish, there was a young band from Long Island called the Star Spangles who took a hell of a lot of flack. They put out, I think, just one album on Capitol. We saw them open up for the Smithereens, and they were absolutely fantastic. Young, and they were filled with energy and, you know, piss and vinegar.
Yeah.
And they got slaughtered by everybody for being bandwagon jumpers, which is bullshit because it was 150,000 of these bands all at once. And so far, none of them have ever made any mark anyway. So it just goes to show you, you just look silly. You know, the Killers were supposed to be this big thing, and they didn't do anything for me, you know. The best thing I can think of as far as a great band that wrote really catchy, hooky songs, the Kaiser Chiefs.
Yeah, right.
The Kaiser Chiefs managed to do it for three or four albums. You know what I mean? From the minute you hear I Predict a Riot, you are sucked in. And the first time I heard that, the first thing that came out of my mouth were, I know exactly what this is. In order, it's The Jam, XTC, and Blur. I'm right. I don't need to argue about it. And a couple of weeks later, I was reading an interview with them. Oh, our biggest influences are The Jam, XTC, and Blur. And I thought, well, well, well.
Right.
The man with the golden ear lives.
Yeah.
But the fact is, those guys can write a song, and they can they're an instantly classic band. And I know they've taken a lot of shit because everybody's a critic. But you know what? That was your last great hope, and that was 1996.
Yeah, really. It's been 20 years since then.
2006. I apologize.
Yeah, so we're talking about a 10-year span since then. And that's the thing. There was a reason why it was always a grind. There was a reason why the music industry was hard, because you had to weed out the guys whose heart wasn't in it. And I get that. But now, in that span of 10 years, or really 20 years, going all the way back to the death of grunge, which didn't die soon enough, the grind has turned around to grinding the people who have the talent and have the passion and have the desire and just kicking them in the teeth over and over again because they're not instantly commoditized. Like you said, if they're not instantly saleable, if they're not, and if it's not the image before the art, before the music, before anything else that is able to grab the attention of somebody as they're seeing somebody fly by on TV, then forget it. It's not going to happen for them. And the industry, that grind has turned around into something that won't let it happen for them. There can't be another pop idol that means anything.
Well, the current music industry, first of all, is a non-existent thing. Calling it the music industry is almost a tragic fallacy because there's only, what, three quote-unquote major labels left, which is in and of itself a joke slash insult since they're all conglomerates that Pac-Man each other to death with the exception of Warner Music Group, who mere, you know, and they're a mere shell of what they were when I worked for them, you know. At least when I was there, you still had the competitors. You still had Columbia. You still had RCA. You still had PolyGram, Polydor, Island, A&M. You had fucking Universal. You had EMI.
You know,
you had the competition out there. And suddenly Universal managed to suck up and vacuum up PolyGram and gutted all of them. Now they've taken EMI, gutted all of them, and given the leftovers to Warner. Columbia took over RCA. I mean, there's got to be something illegal about that, but I don't want to go off onto the music industry end of it. Go back to the 80s and talk about instant marketing. And this is where it's as vivid to me as I'm sure it is to you. The first time you saw and or heard, especially when you saw Lloyd Cole in the Commotions, or you saw Tommy Keane, you know, or you saw the Style Council, you know, or you saw REM, or you saw Wham!, you know, because now we're speaking about a very specific period. It was after that first wave of the punk bands all called it a day. By 83, they were all gone.
Yep.
So now they're on to the next phase, and it was this kind of over-stylized, you know, the haircuts and the precise outfits, and everybody had a shtick, you know. Now, it might be unfair because I absolutely love and respect Lloyd Cole and the Commotions music, and Lloyd Cole is one of the greatest lyricists ever, but they definitely tried to pigeonhole him as one of those. He was the anti-pop star because he was an intellectual. Uh-huh. So they're going for a niche, you know. And Tommy Keane, who had come along with a song like Places That Are Gone, they tried to immediately pigeonhole him, but they weren't sure how because it wasn't like these were cutesy songs. Yeah, they wanted to tout him as, dare I say it, power pop, but even the phrase power pop became dirty at that point.
Yeah.
Now, that wasn't a marketable commodity. The Style Council looked like idiots because Paul Weller had come out of the Jam and suddenly he was doing this and it felt like an obnoxious spoof. You
know? Yeah, very much so. And yet there were, power pop bands. That did it right, you know, even forgetting all of that stuff, but they were so few and far between, and most of them had their roots back in the 70s. I mean, they had been around for that long, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's to come now. I don't think anybody does, but what I can say is even the ones that were supposed to be, that were shoved at us by that machine as, well, here's a band that's doing something different. Watch Lady Antebellum, or watch what was the one, Mumford and Sons? Watch. Exactly. But even if it's not your thing, where are they? They hit 2 years ago. Where are they?
They're building up their myth.
Right, but there's no expectation of another album from them.
You know, you've got me thinking, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but who's that fucking arrogant band that does that thing where they want their audience to be dressed appropriately and they have all these... I mean, they've got this
I don't know,
whole...
but they can go fuck themselves already.
No, just, it's unbelievable. Look it up, because I can't remember who they are, but... They're this another one of these fucking god awful band of twats like Mumford and Sons, a bunch of no talent shitheads that you know say that they want their audience to wear, you know, be dressed appropriately, and you have to do this. Who the fuck are you?
Yeah,
eat shit. You know, people pay an arm and a leg for a fucking concert ticket.
Right.
That's a show in and of itself. The cruelty and cost of a show.
Right. And I'm watching it happen again with another talented group of people that I'm sure they're still having fun doing what they're doing, but there's only so long you can do that without it grinding you down to a nub, because there's no hope of a next thing. You know, there's a band called the Black Lilies, and they write intelligent stuff, and it's fun to listen to, and it's different. And, you know, and they're talented enough to be a big thing. They will never be anything but a touring bar band.
And, you know, look, on the flip side of that, we've seen something as wonderful as the Bongos getting back together and perform occasionally, but they don't go beyond that certain perimeter. I think, you know, even though we're all older now, they certainly have it in them, because when you see them play it, I don't think it's a nostalgia trip. I think it's when you see them play now, they still play with the same kind of abandon and passion and fire that they could go into a studio and easily pick up where they left off with Phantom Train.
Yeah. You know,
that's how good and in tune they are with each other, but how good of a band they are. Very few who have been down the path can say that and do that. I mean, look at REM. There's a band that stuck around far much longer than they should have.
Yeah, they did.
You know, and I'm talking about even before Bill Berry left. I think in the grand scheme of things, and after having a lot of time to go back and reassess it, they should have bagged it right after the Hi-Fi album, New Adventures in Hi-Fi, because that was the album where I had just started working at Atlantic Records, and my friend Ben, who was one of the art directors and a Georgia native, came in and he was like, hey, I just got the new REM album over from the Warner Brothers people. And this is, of course, before it was released. And he put it on, and we're sitting there, and we're all eating lunch, and we're listening to it, and everyone's just kind of looking around at each other. And I said, well, in the immortal words of Bob Dylan when he was first played Sergeant Pepper, turn that crap off.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to drag you off into a totally different arena now, but you're absolutely right. The point of this is, listen to Pugwash, you'll like him. But
this is why we do what we do, folks.
That's right. I think that's
the standards.
I think that's now where that thread started. But my favorite thing that happened today, and it actually isn't happening until next February, but the word is out about what's coming to Los Angeles February 4th of 2018, and I all I can say is I hope it's done right. Are you a museum person much?
Yes.
So I'm the same way.
I was boycotting them in New York.
And
we had that conversation.
I understand why. But I love when somebody takes a concept and is able to build a museum around it. This is an odd example, but there was an episode of The Jeffersons one point where George realized his dream of opening the Museum of Dry Cleaning, and it was hilarious. But see, if there was a Museum of Dry Cleaning, I would go to that. I would love to see that, just because I like that kind of offbeat shit. So February 4th of 2018, in Los Angeles, they are opening the Museum of Failure, and I see that was my reaction, and I hope they do it right, because it would be easy in this era to have a social media driven quote unquote epic fail museum. And if it's just a bunch of people, you know, whacking themselves in the nuts with a hammer or something, I don't care. But if they do it right and they have a museum of those kinds of pop culture things, especially the stuff that they used to try so hard to sell us. And usually the Edsel, exactly. I want a wing dedicated to the Edsel. I want Studebaker in there. I want,
Hang on. Studebaker just unfortunately ran out of steam by bad management and bad mergers.
Right. But the real failure in Studebaker is that they had the car. In 1963, when they went out of business, they had the Avanti, and they released them as a Studebaker for 1 year, and it just wasn't enough to save them. But I want New Coke in there. I want an exhibit dedicated to fucking New Coke. I want the McDLT. You know, I want all that stuff. And I think it could be hilarious and informative and fun.
Dat tapes.
Yes, Dat. Beta.
The original Laserdisc.
Yes, exactly. And the mini disc machine. And, you know, the, I mean, just with technology alone, the one thing that the article that I saw did mention is the Apple Newton. Do you remember that thing?
Yes, I do. That that was the PDA. Yeah. A friend of mine, and this is when I just started working at Atlantic, had a lot of money and stock invested in Apple at the time.
Yes.
And he invested big when Newton was being announced. And I never saw somebody basically turn white in my life when he heard that, you know, like the stocks had plummeted with Apple. And I said, it's going to be okay. We're all on Apple computers as it is. At least the computers will sustain. You'll bounce back. And what was it, a year later, something called an iMac was introduced.
Right.
And so when we lost our jobs, it was okay for him.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I mean, well, and that's the thing, is that sometimes you need that kind of failure. But the thing is, the Newton was, for its day, a more than capable device. It was just a little bit ahead of its time. I mean, it was a little too big and clunky. And the PDAs that came out the next generation after it were the ones that really took off.
It was literally 2 years after. That was 96.
Yes.
95, 96. 98 was when we first started hearing the words Palm Pilot.
Right, right.
And I had a Palm Pilot in 99, you know, because that was my first foray into, you know, modern technology. So, you know, I'm hip. I'm with it.
Right.
You
know? And they, I mean, they did advance the technology. That was the first device that you could write on with a stylus, and it could read your handwriting and translate it into computer text. The Newton did that, you know? So the innovation was there. It just didn't quite work. But you think of how many, well, even ad campaigns, going back to the burger thing and the and New Coke. Do you remember Herb? From the Burger King commercials, the only man in America who had never tried a Whopper.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
They did this in probably 1985, and the idea was they had this schlubby actor who was, you know, just nobody, and they said, this is Herb, the only man who's never tried a Burger King Whopper. And the idea was that you were supposed to, if you saw this guy, you were supposed to try to get him, you know, if you ran into him at a Burger King, and they had him do appearances, a couple of them, you were supposed to try to get him to try the Whopper. And it, there were prizes that they were going to give away, $1 million and all of this stuff. And it just failed. The ad campaign flopped. Nobody cared. And it turned out that the guy showed up at a Los Angeles Burger King and nobody knew. Nobody recognized him. So even with $1 million on the line, they couldn't make her work.
It would have to be a floor full of cars, really.
Yeah.
Okay. Edsel and Studebaker aside, the Pacer.
Oh, yeah. The Yugo.
Okay. The original, here's one for you, the original Dodge Lancer and Valiant with the push buttons.
Yep, yep.
The Yugo, as you had said.
How about the DeLorean? There's a car that almost happened.
Where do you want to go, Marty?
Yeah, well, you know, as Gallagher said, the problem with John DeLorean is he made a car that would only go anywhere there was a white line. So, yeah. Just terrible. You know, they weren't bad-looking cars, but they were so poorly engineered. I mean,
I look at those, and I look at the other day we saw a Lamborghini on, you know, on the expressway here, and I, you know, those are just fucking useless cars, man. Those are
right.
Maybe it's just me. I never had a Jones for that kind of thing. If I was going to go out of my way, you know, to get a, you know, I'm a dick car.
Yeah.
I get like a 66 Mustang.
Right, right. Yeah.
That'll get more trim than a fucking Lambo or an Alfa Romeo.
Yeah, the one guy that I knew when I was in school who had a hard-on for the Lamborghinis, and I think he's got a couple of them now. Well, let me put it this way. He ended up an airline pilot, so that ought to tell you a little bit about who Steve was. But yeah, he was exactly the douchebag that you would think would want a Lamborghini. You know,
first to drive the what do you call it? Remember the IROC?
The IROXY. Yes, yes, I
it's
do.
Retards on coke.
Right. God.
You know, don't forget New York. You know, the big fail was the you know, once well, disco. That would be a great thing for,
yep.
You know, 'cause what happened? The big buildup, and then When it went bust, boy, that was just like one big toilet getting clogged up.
Not to mention that it went out with probably the biggest failure of a promotional gag ever when Steve Dahl did the Death of Disco thing at Wrigley Field and blew up the albums and it turned into a riot.
It just goes to show you how much people really hated Disco.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, I hope that whatever they do with this Museum of Failure, that it's at least intelligently done and that it's well put together.
What's great about that, and it makes me excited, simply because, you know, in my travels through the South, especially in a town like Memphis, which is great, every other block there's a different kind of museum, albeit a tiny one. Like, there's this little tiny museum called the Southern Folk Tales.
Yep.
Museum, and then this wonderfully weird mixture, the Bells Museum of Judeo and Asian Art.
That sounds fantastic. I would have to go there if I drove past.
Jewish guys, Asian women. I mean, that seems to be the thing nowadays. It used to be in the days of greater oppression, obviously, Jewish guys and black girls.
Right.
You know, that was, you know. But and then of course you've got the Stax Museum. You've got the Rock and you've got this. The Rock and Roll Museum down there, you've got the Sun, you've got Graceland, and there are about four different museums for Elvis.
Right.
I mean, it's a town. Oh my God, the Brooks Museum of Art is magnificent. It's just a town ripe with museums, but all through the South, you'll find these. There's the Puppet Museum in Atlanta, which is hilarious and intriguing. You know, New York, we just have shady museums that they charge an arm and a leg for because tourists are stupid enough.
Well, and the one thing that they have in Memphis that you didn't mention, and every time we tell people we're going to Memphis and we still haven't gone, I want to go. There's a place down there called the Sheet Metal Museum. And it sounds like the dumbest thing in the entire world, but everybody that's been there tells me it's great.
And there's also the Cotton Museum.
There you go. So, yeah, go to Memphis, I guess, is the moral to this story. But still.
Right. Memphis, Tennessee, you know. Yeah. Long distance information. More than that, I cannot add.
Yeah.
That's a bizarre song. I've still yet to figure out if it's a father calling to see his child or some creepy, dirty old man. You know, Maria's only 5 years old. Information, please. I don't know. Yeah, it's a very fucked up song.
We can hope it's the dad. But yeah, I've got something stashed away that we actually put out on Facebook earlier this week that I was going to throw at you. And I didn't check the thread to see if you had mentioned it. But before we get to In Our Heads.
Was it, wasn't it Canadian?
Yes. Yeah.
Hey man, you're fucking with me totally. You know how I feel about Canada.
Right.
I'm ready to go to war tomorrow. Blame Canada.
Oh, understood. But is there anything else you wanted to hit before we get to In Our Heads?
Oh, there are a lot of things I want to hit. Let's start with both Junior Trumps. I want to hit both of them with a bat.
Yeah.
Until they don't flinch. Those two are that's like the scraping the gene pool. And it's like after jizz, you know? It's just really... I mean, these two fucking mongoloids need to be taken out. I'm sorry. I usually don't feel like bashing on someone, but they're the exception. I just look at those two and I want to just fuck them up.
Yeah. And what do they do? What's their big claim to fame? Hunting exotic species.
And saying stupid shit in the press to make their father look absolutely brilliant.
That's the only way to do it.
Oh, God. So I want to hit that. We talked about sports, right? Well, we talked about getting tickets.
Yeah.
And that's just a fucking grievance. We'll have to do a whole show dedicated to paying an arm and a leg for any kind of tickets, whether it's baseball, football, hockey, or a concert.
Yeah.
You're getting great.
If they had
not sit for a week.
You know what? The only solution to that, and you're absolutely right, it's so shitty because between the ticket brokers and StubHub and everything else, you can't get tickets, whatever it is you want. And it doesn't matter if it's something mediocre. All the tickets are gone, and if you want to see it, it's going to cost you twice face value. And the only way to stop it is to stop pre-selling tickets. You want tickets to something? Buy them at the door.
Or do it the way we used to have to do it. You know, you had to call. Remember, 10 o'clock a.m., tickets go on sale.
Right.
And you just keep calling until you got through.
Yeah.
And hopefully there'll be tickets left. Nirvana was the biggest band in the world, and at 10 o'clock that morning, I was taking my cousin to see them for her birthday gift, because she was turning 15, and that was that time when a 15-year-old loved Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
So for her birthday, I was taking her, and I got through, and I got two tickets.
Yeah. Right. You
know? And, it wasn't impossible.
But somebody will find a way to hack the phone system and get away with it. So there's just no way. No way to make it work right.
Okay, before we go into this segment, will you please rise for the singing of the Canadian national anthem? Oh, Canada, home and native land, buddy.
Yeah, I don't even know where this came from, but I must have heard something, I guess, this week. Maybe it was something that my iPod pulled up. As a matter of fact, yes, it was. That's exactly what started it off, because I hit Switch into Glide, and This Beat Goes On by the Kings.
I have lots of friends that I can ding at any time. Can mobilize some laughs with just one call. Like a bunch of lunatics, we'll act your way fast on. Sure, we'll be rocking till our strength is gone.
One of those songs that, you know, it's two songs, honestly, but it's one of those pieces of music that I cannot not listen to. If I hear those first couple of strains, that E chord start, boom, I'm there and I'm in for the whole 7.5 minute ride. And it was really the only thing they did that ever got any airplay. But I know some people who were sort of friends of their circle up in Toronto and said that they were the nicest guys in the entire world. Cause of course, you know, they're Canadian and said that, you know, on stage as a live act, they were great.
Hang on. Let's have a little disclaimer. Their beady little eyes and their, you know, square wheeled car.
Yeah, I know.
You know, dick and fart jokes. Thanks to Terrence and Philip. Mm-hmm. Immoral degenerates. I take umbrage. They're weird alphabet.
Yes.
And
why do they?
Okay, elemental buddy.
And why do they keep adding U's to words like flavor and color? What the fuck is that all about?
I think they're still British.
Oh right, okay. And I love the fact that on the quarter they put the queen on one side and a beaver on the other one. What the hell is that all about? What are they trying to say there?
I ain't touching that one either.
But, you know, aside from Anne Murray and Brian Adams, there has to be something else decent that comes from Canada.
Neil Young.
Yeah.
You know, we forget Neil Young is Canadian, but Neil Young is Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, 3/5 of Buffalo Springsteen were, in fact, Canadian. It wasn't just Neil Young. It was Dewey Martin and Bruce Palmer.
Right. Okay.
Get that. But nonetheless, Neil Young, and Neil Young. Oh, you want me to say Rush, don't you?
Well, see, that's the thing, is that's always going to be the stopper. Is Rush really worthwhile or not?
You know what? When you can go 40 years of making albums and still have people come out to see you and pack the house, it's not a stopper. It's, hey, there's something. And look, I never liked Rush, but like every other band that I never liked, I find something good at least in one or two songs, you know. I think Permanent Wave is a great album. You know, Limelight's a great song.
Yeah.
Tom Sawyer, fucking epic. You know, Red Barquetta is epic. My personal favorite of all things is Distant Early Warning, where, you know, I just always found it hysterical with Geddy going, "Red Alert!"
Rising across the cities of the plain. There's no swimming in the heavy water, no singing in the acid rain. Red alert, red alert. It's so hard to stay together, passing through revolving doors. We need someone to talk to and someone to sweep the floors.
I love that song. I love that one and Spirit of Radio. I mean, I know it's not the greatest piece of music ever, but I like it. I think it's fun.
Right. Now, I did read through the thread, and, you know, I threw in Cinnamon Girl because your question was very specific. It was, what's the greatest opening riff?
Well, that's where it ended up. But yeah, I just started it with the song by a Canadian band or artist that you love. Just picking one in particular.
Right, and the fact is, the only one that I could think of with such a great, memorable, and just a fucking powerhouse riff is Cinnamon Girl.
Right.
You can't miss with that. But you want to go for a really left field kind of shot. Now, you brought up the Kings, and you and I both remember that song very well.
Oh, yeah.
Because that song was enormous in New York, in the tri-state area. Like this part of the country, that song was everywhere.
Yep.
Just like Where Do All the People Go by the Monroes, which no one else has ever heard of. they're not Canadian. That doesn't count.
Yeah.
It's the point of it. Eyes of a Stranger by the Paolas.
That is a fantastic piece of music.
You give me a topic, and I think about it for a moment, and then I remember all this useless information rattles around in there, and I should just go on Jeopardy.
Yeah, exactly. And I got to go back to another one of my favorites of all time, because Basketball Jones by Cheech and Chong was actually written by Tommy Chong, who is, in fact, Canadian. So I guess that works its way in there, too. And a hell of a guitar player, by the way.
And, of course, one of my favorite songs of all time. And this could have gone into what we were talking about before with Next Big Thing, because mm-hmm. they were touted as the Next Big Thing. The Last Song by Edward Bear.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, so there were, and of course, anything that Randy Bachman was involved in has that.
The Guess Who had some great songs.
The closest thing Canada has to cool is Randy Bachman.
Yeah, I mean, come on. You know, people will make the argument of, taking care of business versus, there's no verses. You ain't seen nothing yet, baby. It's just fucking majestic.
Right.
That was when you're 8, 9 years old and you hear that and you're rocking out as a little kid and you have no idea why, that's why.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, Canada does have a few things to offer after all. Hockey, exactly.
Now, let me ask you this, because you are from Buffalo area. Did Toronto have the first Tim Hortons, or was it Buffalo? Where did he start it?
That's a good question. I think they started north of the border. But Timmy played for the Sabres, so I'm not sure. I'll have to go back and check.
You had Tim Hortons up there, didn't you?
Yes. And in fact, we have them now in St. Louis, and there's something going on because they just closed two of the best locations in town of Tim Hortons. I think there were something like 14 or 15 of them, and they just closed the downtown location and the one in the central West End. And it doesn't seem to be a problem with sales. It's not that they were failing. There's some kind of pissing match going on, a legal pissing match between the franchisee and Tim Hortons corporate. And I hope they get their shit sorted out, because if I lose the Tim Hortons here in town, I'm not going to be happy.
Okay, here's the thing. Mid-90s, they were taken over for the United States market on a broader scale and were merged into Wendy's.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And the reason I know this and hear me out is because I took a bus ride to see the woman I was dating at the time and the tail end of our relationship. And, there was Tim Hortons and I'd never had Tim Hortons. It was just a myth, because we don't have them in New York City.
Okay.
We only have... At that point, we only had, of course, Dunkin' Donuts, which is every 10 steps. It's Dunkin' Donuts, 7-Eleven, wash, rinse, repeat.
Yep. And Subway.
And Subway, and the Chinese food place, and a pizzeria, and a Korean nail place, and a bodega.
Yep.
Wash, rinse, repeat. But then we had Krispy Kreme, which I had only known from my travels in the South.
Out of North Carolina, right.
That exploded, and that went away. But then... And the wretched woman that I was seeing, she was on a business trip to Ohio. And when she came back to New York to visit, she actually brought me Tim Hortons for the first time. So I had the double chocolate frosted and the blueberry cake donuts, which were absolutely spectacular.
Those are if somebody walked up to me and said, I'm going to Tim Hortons for the first time, what should I get? Those would be the two I would lay out.
She also, wretched that she was, she actually brought me a can of their coffee, which was magnificent.
Yeah.
And And she brought me a travel mug, you know, one of the long travel mugs, which is in my car to this day, and a little travel coffee cup, which I always take with me when I go on trips.
Nothing wrong with that.
Now, almost as quickly as that happened, they were gone from even Wendy's. And then all of a sudden, they sprang up in New York about 3 or 4 years ago. In New York City.
Okay.
They started appearing in places like, first of all, we lost Krispy Kreme completely. They packed up and went away after the whole, what was that big wave diet thing that everybody went
on? Oh, Atkins, yeah.
Thank you. After Atkins, suddenly that was gone. So Tim Horton appears in New York City, in Penn Station, and attached to Pizza Hut and KFCs, right? But then, miraculously, Staten Island got a standalone Tim Hortons that was actually in a building that had been a Dunkin' Donuts after the Dunkin' Donuts across the street expanded. So they closed the original Dunkin' Donuts, moved into this big building, then closed it and moved back across the street.
I love it.
And, right? Standalone Tim Hortons, seats, sandwiches, they have a little fireplace. Very cozy. You go in. It's kind of like a very sacred moment.
Yeah.
And I get a coffee, and I went with my standbys, you know, Boston cream and strawberry frosted with sprinkles. My wife gets the Nutella donut.
Ooh.
Once again, all bets are off because Tim Hortons is the shit, yo. That is the fucking bomb diggity G.
There you go. Well,
and now we've got three standalones, and they are doing business money hand over fist here.
As well, so it should be.
That's, you know, Tim Hortons rules, even though, you know, there's nothing better than a Dunkin' Donuts blueberry iced coffee.
Fair
and
enough.
And fuck that Starbucks shit, you know.
Oh, like, yeah.
You know, only douchebags will go to Starbucks for anything but the drinks. If you're going to go in there and drink the coffee, you're full of shit.
Especially, well, here's my bitch with Starbucks. Is first of all, they burn everything they make, which is okay, fine, but it's Starbucks.
Including the coffee.
And right, exactly. And I am the guy who goes to places like that and just gets a cup of, just give me a cup of coffee. I'll put a little cream in it and we'll both be happy and I'll get out of your hair. I don't want some soy latte bullshit. So because of that, I know a little bit about my coffee, and I know what I like. And what I like is African coffees. As far from Africa as, like, Sumatra, going into Indonesia, that area. But Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya, all these places, the coffee that they grow there tastes like no coffee from anywhere else in the world. I don't like Colombian coffee. I'm a coffee bitch snob. So I like my African coffee, but Starbucks used to have the signs that would say Sumatra or Kenya AA or Colombian or whatever.
French roast and all of that.
Right.
Because they had the scooter on the Italian one.
Right. But they've taken all of that away and they've just, you know, now they have Pike's Place or whatever the cutesy name that they put on their coffee. And I don't know what's in there, so I'm not going to drink it.
Well, Pike's is their cheapo blend.
Okay. That's
it's their cheapo, you know, $1.99 cup. If you just want a cup of coffee, it's not bad. The decaf version is better. If you drink decaf, you're a homo, but right. You know, if you get the Christmas blend, that's a nice flavor. It's smooth. You know, now me, I like Colombian coffee. Starbucks don't carry it. You know what I get? I get fucking Maxwell House Colombian.
Right.
Because Maxwell House is a man's coffee. Okay.
Yeah,
if I go to Starbucks, I'm not going to buy a fucking coffee. I'll just buy a drink, you know. Green iced tea, that's fine if I'm feeling like that, you know. Or if I'm in the mood for something, you know, a little frothy, I'll get myself a caramel frappuccino, full fat, you know, in the milk and full fat in the what do you call it? Because if you're going to go in there and order one of these and get, can I have it with soy?
Yeah.
And with non-fat creamer, I'll give you a non-fat creamer. I'll give you a protein creamer.
Yeah.
Like a man, don't be a pussy.
It's one of the reasons why I was very sad to see Borders Books go away, because Borders Books all had a coffee shop in them, and it was something Joe.
It was Seattle's Best.
No, that's the other one. That's Barnes & Noble that had them. Or did Barnes & Noble have Starbucks?
Barnes & Noble has Starbucks here.
Okay. But yeah, you're right.
Seattle's Best.
I was thinking Books A Million. Books A Million was the one that had the other coffee shop, and I wish I could remember what it was called. But
it wasn't Pete's, was it?
It wasn't Pete's, was it? No, it had Joe in the name. It might have just been Joe's Cafe or something like that, but they were all the same in all the Books A Millions, and they always had Kenya AA ready to go. That was one of their standbys. That was their dark roast standby, and it was brilliant. So,
Order it from someplace?
I don't know, because since Books A Million's gone, they took the cafes with them, but probably. I'm sure there's a Javalia version of it online somewhere.
Yeah, no, listen, there's a place, if it's still here, here's the magic words, if it's still in business, that's been on Bleecker Street for 100 fucking years, called Puerto Rico, P-O-R-T-O, Puerto Rico Coffee Company.
Okay.
Because whenever my darling cousin Valerie comes to New York, I always take her there to buy her a couple of bags of whatever she wants to get. I'll see if they've got Kenyan AA there.
Excellent.
Because it's all the beans.
Right.
You know? You just take the bags of beans. They just, you know, sell it by weight.
Hey.
So I'll get a bag of beans.
Well, if you see Joey Bag of Beans, tell him I said hi.
How you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
How's it hanging? How's your melon smelling?
Now, I know this is the totally off-the-cuff, just straight-out-of-our-heads version of this show, but there is one thing that I want to have you promote, because I haven't even listened to it yet, but I saw that you had a review go up online. Is it May Erlewine? Is that her name?
Yes. Yes, Mother Lion. This is her 10th album. And, you know, I was very honest in my review. I said, you know, this is not the kind of thing you're going to find in my – I got out of my wheelhouse, you know.
Good.
And it was just a really beautiful and moving album. You know, it's very rich. And what I loved so much about it, and it's a favorite topic of yours and mine, is that completely dry vocals.
Good.
Included an understated production on the instrumentation. It's simple, yet it's rich and it's full. And you can tell that even though this is her 10th album, she's not mailing this stuff in.
Good.
She's somebody who's still driving with a passion to do these wonderful songs that I know it's going to sound corny and cliched, but there's a spark of hope in every one of those songs, even though some of them are you know, melancholic and reflective and can be a bit of an emotional roller coaster if you get yourself absorbed into the lyrical, because they're stories. There's hope in all of them. And that's very warming at a time when we desperately need something, anything. Notice how I just plugged Todd Rundgren accidentally. you'll grab it and you'll take it and you'll hold on to it. But the thing is, it's a wonderfully consistent album.
Good. I will spend this week giving that a listen and, of course, reading the full review that's on Popdos, and then we'll go fully into that album from May Erlewine and more on our next get-together on Radio City. Anything else you want to promote for then?
I want to promote this. You know, last Friday was, of course, Record Store or Let's Butt Fuck the Customers Day, because it was, of course, Black Friday. Hashtag Black Friday Lives Matter.
That's right.
Guess what suddenly came out last Friday, and I wasn't even thinking about it initially. There was this double live Big Star vinyl from the concert that, of course, Thank You Friends was taken from. So I bought it. You know, I waited till Black Friday was over, and I was able to get brand new copy on eBay. I didn't get raked over the coals, and I didn't have to go schlepping out into any stores because I'm not a fucking moron. But I got it.
Good.
So that's on its way to me now, along with the Chris Bell box set, which I am waiting for patiently as I salivate. I mean, I know the material. You know the material. We all know the material. But to have the actual physical 6-LP box set in my hands will be a thrill.
Good deal. Well, we'll break that open next time we get together. And, Rob, always a pleasure, man. Have yourself a great week.
Thank you, John. Take care of yourself. Feel well. And I'll see you soon.